Senator John Thune returns to Sioux Falls after visiting the U.S. border with Mexico. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Monday, March 29th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with Senator Thune about the 2018 Remain in Mexico policy, Title 42, and public health threats at the border, and why he says his concern about immigration and asylum seekers is ongoing. Lee Strubinger joins us for a look at Veto Day in Pierre. Then, just weeks after Sioux Falls dropped a mask mandate, the city is once again considered a hotspot for COVID-19. We'll bring you an update. We hear an incredible story of suffering and survival on today's Images of the Past. Plus, live music returns to Deadwood in a big way. We preview the Deadwood Live Open Air Music Series. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Governor Kristi Noem is pitching lawmakers a proposal that would limit parts of a voter-passed law legalizing medical marijuana in South Dakota. Noem's proposal asks lawmakers to limit the number of cannabis plants allowed in a medical pot user's home to 3. It also prevents anyone under the age of 21 from smoking or vaping medical cannabis. The implementation of medical marijuana is still July 1st. The Republican leader in the Senate says the proposal is a starting point for discussions. Democrats agree. Senator Troy Hinert says a special session seems likely.
We should have taken the 40 days that we're in Pierre and worked on that issue. We just didn't. And we got to the end and they tried to rush something through that completely went against the will of the voter. And, you know, on the Senate side, that just wasn't going to fly. So I think we should just honor the will of the people, institute the program, and if we need to make changes next year in January, that's when we do it.
Noem previously pushed the legislature to delay implementation of the program by a year so a committee could study the issue, but that push failed. In a letter to lawmakers, Noem acknowledged today is the last legislative day of the year and says the changes are necessary to successfully implement a medicinal program. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe has taken down the coronavirus checkpoints on its South Dakota reservation. It had become a point of contention between the tribe, Republican Governor Kristi Noem, and the Trump administration. Cheyenne River spokesman Remy Bald Eagle says the tribal council made the decision to take down the 9 checkpoints because of declining infection rates and the arrival of COVID-19 vaccines on the reservation. The tribe is also hoping to work with President Joe Biden's new Bureau of Indian Affairs staff to maintain control over its police department. That's after the Trump administration sent a letter in December of 2020 saying the agency would begin managing the department. Public health experts warn false information about COVID-19 vaccines could hinder efforts to mitigate coronavirus spread. Aaron Hunt is a public health professor at South Dakota State University. He says people should be wary of claims circulating on social media, including one that the shots are deadly.
The death one, yeah, that was really concerning and very misleading because the clinical trials, when they were closely monitoring thousands of people, they did not see that at all.
Hunt says each federally approved vaccine is thoroughly reviewed. He encourages residents to get vaccinated as soon as they can because South Dakota is seeing a rise in COVID infections. The South Dakota Department of Health is using the Helpline Center and the rideshare service Lyft to give people rides to vaccination appointments. To use the service, people must have their appointment scheduled ahead of time. Shanice Behrens is one of the leaders of the program. She hopes it will provide a useful service for South Dakotans.
And we had seen partnerships with Lyft like this happening on a national level and thought that it might be something that we could do here in South Dakota.
Barron says Lyft has already helped 45 people get to their appointment. For weather today, we're seeing sunny skies across the state. It's incredibly warm and windy. Today's highs are in the lower 50s northwest to the lower 80s in the southeast. Evening lows are in the mid-teens northwest to the lower 30s in the southeast. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. U.S. Senator John Thune visited the U.S. border with Mexico in an effort to assess a springtime surge of asylum seekers at the border. I spoke with Senator Thune this morning.
You said that the crisis at the U.S. border with Mexico is President Biden's making. Apprehension surge last April, surpassing the surge of 2019. So do you really believe the idea that Joe Biden is a compassionate man is causing the current surge of asylum seekers in 2021?
I don't know that necessarily that Joe Biden on his own, but I do think his policies are contributing to that. And I think he's getting a lot of advice that probably isn't good. One of the things we learned when we were down there is that the Border Patrol met with the Biden transition team more than once when they were coming into office, and basically forewarned them that if they went away from some of these policies, that you would see this influx. And even though we've had surges in the past, this exceeds those, and this is the worsening by the day. I mean, they're setting new records every day, and they've got literally thousands of people now who are interpreting what's happening there or interpreting the signal sent by the new administration as a green light to come. And so it's created a real humanitarian crisis. I mean, you got kids that are just packed in like sardines. It breaks your heart to see what's happening to those unaccompanied children in some cases families. But I do think that the suspension of the, building of the border wall, I think the, revoking the emergency declaration of the previous administration that they'd put in place for the border, which enabled them to use some emergency powers, doing away with the Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers, all those things, changes, have created an atmosphere now that is conducive to getting more people coming across illegally. And, the downside of that, obviously, is you have, when you've got an open and porous border, people exploit it. And the traffickers who are charging these people thousands of dollars, the cartels that are smuggling drugs, all that's ramped up here in the last 60 days or so. And so it's we've had issues there for some time, but I think the signal sent, the policies changes made by the new administration, no doubt have contributed to what we're seeing down there now.
So is it true that fewer than 1% of asylum seekers are still being accepted into the U.S.? That doesn't seem like an open border policy.
No, and that's not true. I mean, right now, anybody who comes in, if you're a family and you've got a child under six, you're accepted into the country. The difference is the asylum seekers in the previous administration under the Remain in Mexico policy, or what they called the Migrant Protection Plan program, had Mexico holding the asylum seekers there until their hearings could be done and then their cases adjudicated before they came in. Now they're coming in, and because we don't have the capacity, and one of the issues we need more judges down there. We don't have the capacity to process these people as they're being released into the country. And, one of the things that we found out too when we were down there is there are a lot of folks that are coming across the border. When I say a lot, much higher percentage in terms of infection rate than here in the United States, people coming in with COVID. And so, I just think it's a public health crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis when you look at those pods that these kids are packed into. And when you think about the fact that 50% now the Border Patrol is spending their time taking care of these kids in these facilities rather than actually doing their job and policing the border, there's a resource problem, there's a manpower problem, and a messaging problem with the administration, and they've got to get on it. I mean, the Biden administration has got to do something to fix this. And our effort down there was essentially to draw attention to it and to help educate the public and hopefully a little bit the media, and to some degree put pressure on the administration to put policies in place that will change the incentives so that people will look for legal ways to come to the country rather than coming in here illegally.
So my understanding is that Joe Biden rescinded the 2018 Remain in Mexico policy, but Title 42 is still in place, which closes the border for public health reasons. Am I understanding that incorrectly? Isn't Title 42 still in place?
They've modified Title 42, and they are talking, like I said, if you've got a child under six, you're automatically in.
The whole family.
Title 2, correct. And of course, a lot of them there, they'll send them in. They come into these areas down there where they're processing them, just kids wandering in. We were down there with a 3-year-old that just, you know, sort of wandered in, and I assume abandoned by somebody. But, you know, they get in that way. They try and match them up with families in the United States. But, you know, you've got literally every day now thousands coming across, and the numbers are pretty staggering. And I think on a scale unlike what we've seen previously, and I think a lot of it, you know, like I said, these are not issues that are new in terms of we've had surges in the past, but in my view, there's a direct correlation between the changes in messaging that have been put out there by the new administration, the changes in policy, and you know, the current sort of massive a number of people that are coming across. And so it's in the interest of everybody, including those kids that are packed into those pods, we need an orderly approach. We need an approach that recognizes that we are a nation of immigrants, but we're also a nation of laws. And we've got to have laws in place, a process for doing this. And I think the administration's got to jump on this. They really do, because it's gotten out of hand.
One more question, and that's what your response would be for critics who say, where were you when kids were in cages during the Trump administration? Some of those policies that were exceedingly, you know, send the message they're not welcome, and outright cruel in some people's opinions. You didn't speak out like you're speaking out now. How would you respond to those critics?
Well, I've talked about immigration whenever we've had challenges about the importance of having an immigration policy that respects the fact that we are a nation of laws and that we've got to have an orderly way of handling it. I mean, I think a lot of the messaging around the kids being held down there during the previous administration, too, was partly media. Now they used to call them cages. Now we call them pods. I mean, there are kids in pods down there now. I think that the previous administration, although it took them a while to find their footing on this issue, you know, was criticized for not being compassionate and humane enough. But I think what we've got with the current administration is, you know, the opposite, and that is essentially open borders come. And I think that too is a policy that is going to fail the country, because we don't have the capacity. We can't handle these people on this level. We're depleting the border patrol of and taking them away from the job that they're there to do, and that is to defend the border and protect the country. It's a national security issue in that respect. And so, I mean, I think that the current administration has deviated from the policies that were put in place by the previous administration. And they did get it under control. There were periods where we had surges. I think those kind of come this time of the year, but this one exceeds anything we've seen previously and is of great concern to the Border Patrol, because they had, as I said, forewarned the incoming administration, the Biden administration, that this was going to happen, and they ignored their warnings. And I think that's the lesson in all this, is you need to listen to the people who are actually trying to do the job down here, because they care about these people too. They want to see them treated humanely, but they don't have the capacity to do it. And right now we don't have a process that enables us to handle just the flow that's coming across. I think before you can address these other issues, you got to stop the flow. And that means the new administration has got to send a different message and put different policies in place to discourage people from coming here illegally and encourage them to follow the law.
That's Senator John Thune talking from Sioux Falls earlier today. It's important to note that seeking asylum in the United States is not illegal. The people being detained at the border are a combination of asylum seekers and those who were apprehended crossing illegally. So for context, first, asylum seekers. In 2019, the United States admitted 29,916 refugees and asylum seekers, mostly from African and Asian countries. 809 people were admitted that year from Latin America and Caribbean countries. About 1% of those total refugee admissions came from El Salvador. In 2019, the refugee ceiling was set at the lowest level since the inception of the program in 1980. Now, illegal crossings. U.S. Customs and Border Protection reports approximately 3,000 arrests per day on the southwest border of people attempting to cross between Border Patrol stations. That's daily since January of 2021. Up next, SDPB's Lee Strubinger joins us for a look at Veto Day in the state capitol. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Colleges are relying heavily on cleaning staff to make sure campuses are safe enough for students to be there.
What I had to remind the team was, you're essential, but you have always been essential. Without us, and I'm not trying to be arrogant here, this campus shuts down.
I'm Audie Cornish. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Rise Custom Solutions, providing expert orthotics, prosthetics, wheelchair, and other mobility solutions from centers in Sioux Falls and Rapid City, a division of LifeScape. More at risecs.com.
These days, the scene at home is busier. Hands full, meal in the oven, a dog begging for your attention. With so much going on inside, how can you stay connected to what is going on outside your home? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR. You'll get the latest news from your community and beyond. We'll keep you company while you keep things moving.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly with Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today is veto day in the South Dakota State Legislature. SDPB's Lee Strubinger is in Pierre. He joins us with a look at the business before lawmakers today. Lee Strubinger, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Good to be here. You bet.
What is the work before legislators this veto day?
Well, you could make an argument that some of the work here is already done. The House took up the governor's style and form veto just about an hour ago. They gaveled in at 11 Central and took all but about 15 minutes for them to reject the governor's style and form veto.
That's for House Bill 1217. Explain people what that is. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So this is a bill that its title is to promote and the continued fairness in women's sports. It essentially says that girls' sports shall be reserved for biological girls only. Critics of the legislation say that it would prevent trans girls from playing in girls' sports. And this is something that we're seeing states across the entire country sort of take up. It's become a real conservative piece of legislation that social conservatives are really pushing across the country at this point. And it reached the governor's desk this year, and she issued a kind of a partial veto. She had some concerns with the bill, part of it dealing with collegiate athletes. She wanted to keep it just to high school athletes. Mm-hmm. And then there were some other things that she said would create a trial lawyer's dream that she got rid of as well. And then there was also a mandate that schools kind of collect this waiver form from student athletes that would say their age, their reproductive biology, and whether they'd taken steroids or performance enhancing drugs within the last year. So she kind of took all those out, and then some legislators and conservative groups, national conservative groups, are very quick to condemn this kind of partial veto, if you will, that she issued. And now we're here today. And the House overwhelmingly rejected this style and form veto, mm-hmm. and now we're just kind of sitting around and waiting to see what happens.
Is it done then? Or the governor has said before she might call a special session, and we still don't know if that will happen or not.
We still don't know at this point. I have not heard at this point. I know the House right now is taking their rejection down to the governor's office, or they had mm-hmm. within the last hour. And so now we kind of wait to see if the House will vote to override this veto, because there's kind of a difference of opinion between House leadership and then within the governor's office about what takes place here. So if the House rejected the style and form veto, and so the Constitution says that it only takes a simple majority to accept those changes, but if they don't, it's considered a vetoed bill. And mm-hmm. so if they would have accepted her style and form changes, then the governor would have something to certify and then it would come into law. But because right. the governor has nothing to certify, it's considered a vetoed bill. So the House can still, with a two-thirds majority vote, override that veto and then send it over to the Senate. Senators are just kind of sitting at their desks, sort of waiting to see what the House does.
All right. What about medical marijuana? Is that on the agenda today at all?
It is not on the agenda either. And so, again, when it comes to whether or not a special session will be called, I don't know if that will be on the docket or not, because, you know, these proposed changes were announced kind of late last week. And so mm-hmm. a lot of lawmakers wouldn't have had time to consider them. And then also, you know, giving the public a chance to come and testify on these bills and how they would work. I don't know if that would be the case. I do know the leader in the Senate, Senate President Pro Tem Lee Schoenbeck, has said that, you know, the governor's proposal is kind of like a starting point for discussions. And so I would suspect we would probably see something a little bit later on, but not necessarily this week. But sure. again, a lot is up in the air at this point.
Up in the air. SDPB's Lee Strubinger, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Lee joined us from the Capitol building in Pierre. Up next, Sioux Falls is listed as a hot spot by a White House report just weeks after letting the mask mandate expire. We've got Dr. Chad Torrey from Avera with us for a COVID-19 update. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. President Biden faces the same challenge his predecessors did. What to do about Afghanistan, where U.S. troops have been deployed since 2001?
It is not my intention to stay there for a long time.
We'll speak with former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel about America's longest war. That's next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. 50,000 miles of resilient broadband fiber, supporting online banking and other essential businesses, right where you need it. More at sdncommunications.com.
On the next Fresh Air, The Amazing Lives of Migratory Birds. Author Scott Wiedensahl talks about the millions of birds flying unseen over our heads in the night sky, how the bar-tailed godwit can fly more than a week over water without stopping, and how new tracking technology may help with strategies to keep them alive. His new book is A World on the Wing. Join us.
Monday at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB. The games and activities we watch, cheer for, and participate are highlighted on the SDPB Sports and Recreation Beat, supported by Horton Incorporated of Britton, South Dakota. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Listening to In the Moment, I'm Lori Walsh. As South Dakota moves forward with vaccinations, we're also seeing a rise in new coronavirus infections. Just weeks after a mask mandate was allowed to expire in the city of Sioux Falls, the city is once again considered a hot spot of COVID-19. Plus, the Easter holiday is ahead. Can you gather if not all your family members have received their vaccines? Dr. Chad Torrey is a family medicine physician and regional director of clinical quality with the Avera Medical Group, and he's joining us with an update. Dr. Torrey, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
No problem, and thank you for having me again.
Recent White House report says South Dakota is one of two states with the most concerning positivity trends. Tell us a little bit about what's happening here at home right now with new infections.
Well, certainly we are seeing increased cases here probably over the last week and probably the last couple weeks. Probably a couple different things that are driving that. I think just some people returning back to kind of normal, trying to go back to some type of normalcy without masking. And so it's those getting away from those things that we have talked about over the last year that we know prevent spread of infection, and that's wearing masks, social distancing, avoiding large gatherings, and so on. And so I think some There's just more people that are not doing those things, and that's leading to some of the uptick in cases. And then the other part of it is certainly the variants here in our region, and certainly throughout the rest of the country. We're seeing more of the UK variant, and that is more easily transmissible. And so that's going to cause more quickly increasing numbers as well as far as COVID cases go.
Talk for a moment about masks and the UK variant, things that are more easily spreadable. Are they still defeated by the same mitigation measures that we were using before? If we use them again, are we still in safe territory, or do we need to add precautions?
I guess from what I'm understanding, you know, those basic measures still apply. So wearing a mask, social distancing, avoiding large gatherings. I mean, if you are decreasing the amount of viral particle that you can potentially come in contact with, either through wearing a mask or just not putting yourself in that situation to be around somebody with the virus, then, you know, then it's going to help prevent infection. As far as, you know, what degree of benefit there is as far as wearing masks, if you are around somebody with COVID based off of the new variant versus the, you know, kind of original version of the virus, you know, I'm not sure if I've seen any statistics on that, but I think the same principle still holds that we need to continue to do those things.
Yeah. There was an effort from Avera and other healthcare providers to mask up in South Dakota that we really saw a push for in November and December when those case numbers and the hospital capacity was so desperate. Is that an ongoing thing to really encourage people to wear their masks with a huge push from healthcare providers? Are you getting the support from local leaders and from the state leadership to continue those mitigation efforts in light of rising infection rates?
Well, certainly from the standpoint of Avera in our health ministry, you know, we continue to advocate and push for masking when people are out in public and certainly can't socially distance from other people. Once again, you know, following the CDC guidelines that even if you are vaccinated and out in public, still continuing to wear a mask at this point in time. So we certainly continue to urge people to do that. I think, you know, like I had mentioned initially, there's kind of some, unfortunately, some COVID fatigue, and we see that with municipalities and stuff that have allowed some of their mask mandates to expire. And, you know, I think we tried to lobby on our end that it was perhaps a little premature. But, you know, those are decisions that get made, and we just try to provide as much input as we can on our end.
For people who have been vaccinated and have waited the prerequisite time after, consider themselves at full immunity for right now at least, what's your advice to them regarding, you know, dinners with family and Easter gatherings, particularly if you have someone in your family who has no intention of getting vaccinated or who has not yet been able to get vaccinated?
Yeah, so the CDC, you know, released some guidelines here recently as far as what people can do if they are fully vaccinated, and that means 2 weeks after both your second shot if it's Moderna and Pfizer, or 2 weeks after your Johnson & Johnson vaccine if you get that one. And so what they have said is if you are fully vaccinated, you can be around other people that are fully vaccinated, and in that situation not wear a mask. And so if it's a small gathering and you know for sure and trust that what the other person is telling you, that they got vaccinated, then it's going to be a much lower risk as far as contracting and spreading COVID. Is it zero? No, it's not zero, but it's much less. I think the other question you're kind of getting to now is if I'm fully vaccinated and I'm going to have a big Easter gathering with my family, and part of those family members are not vaccinated, then that is not what the CDC is saying go ahead and do. What they talk about in the other option is if you're fully vaccinated and you want to get be around another single family that is not vaccinated and they are not at high risk for complications if they were to get COVID, then that would be fine too. And I think the intention of that is more, once again, allowing people to have some smaller gatherings with family And so, for instance, kind of the one that I go back to is a grandparent is fully vaccinated. They haven't seen their grandkids for a year because they've been trying to be cautious. And now they want to go see, their son or daughter and their kids and be around the grandkids again. And that would, that is what kind of the CDC is saying fully vaccinated people can do.
Yeah. So to be clear, if I'm fully vaccinated and my sister decides she doesn't want a vaccination, can I hang out with her and be safe? And it's really just her choice to say she's at low risk and she doesn't mind? Or am I putting myself at risk by hanging out with her without a mask?
So you're maybe putting yourself at a little bit of a risk. But once again, if you're fully vaccinated, the probability of getting COVID because you're fully vaccinated is pretty low. I think in that situation, mm-hmm. You'd want to make sure that both people are still masked to try to be, 6 feet apart or more and be as safe as you can in that situation.
Which takes me to my next question in the sense that we have, we've crested 40% of South Dakotans who have received their first vaccine dose. And I think we're in like 27% who have received their full series of vaccinations. We're trying to shoot for something like 70% of vaccination. What if we don't get there? Are we better off than we are today if we get to 50% but not 70? How important is that 70%?
It's important. And just the nature in which viruses work in trying to reduce the number and severity of outbreaks, it's going to be critical to get to kind of that herd immunity threshold. And so we just got to continue to encourage people to get vaccinated and talk about the benefits for vaccination and hope that we get there.
Yeah, you can sort of watch as the state progresses through, one layer of vaccination eligibility. It sort of slows down with the pace that the percentage is increasing, and then they open up to a new group and it starts going up again. Are we seeing overall strong compliance and desire to get vaccinated, or are we seeing signs of hesitancy in certain groups?
I think we've seen really good participation and uptake of vaccinations in our 65 and over population. But what we've noticed is that as you continue to go down in age, the percent of people that are wanting or willing to get vaccinated continues to go down. I think that goes back to maybe some of those thoughts that because I'm younger, I'm at less risk of hospitalization, death, severe disease, and so on. But I think we got to go back to the premise when it comes to vaccinations and thinking about how they work, and that is getting to that herd immunity. And so everybody needs to be a part of the solution and needs to work to get vaccinated, because I don't vaccinate myself just to protect myself, but I also get vaccinated so that I can protect other people and prevent them from getting COVID as well. And so I think we got to have that kind of public health. What's the best for our region and our people that we interact with on a daily basis? And if we kind of keep that in the frame of mind, hopefully more people will kind of heed that advice and go out and get vaccinated, even the younger population that don't think they're at high risk for complications.
All right, Dr. Turie, let's go back to the beginning, because as we open the doors to a new group of eligible South Dakotans, there are people who just, kind of tuned it out because they knew they weren't early on the list. Younger people who are just paying attention to this vaccine right now. Is it safe? Talk a little bit about the safety and how this was received its emergency how these vaccines received emergency authorization from the FDA.
Yeah, I would say from what we know, looking at the data and stuff, these vaccines are extremely safe. I guess there's going to be, some reaction or mild side effects that people notice with any vaccination. Certainly, the COVID vaccinations are the same as far as arm soreness, general aches and pains, maybe some low-grade fevers. But all in all, they are really outstanding vaccinations. When you talk about 90 to 95% decrease in infection rates and in developing symptomatic COVID, I mean, those are just phenomenal. And so I think the benefits for COVID vaccination greatly outweigh any potential risk.
Talk a little bit about the options or the potential for needing booster shots in the future. Is this going to be, what do we know now about whether this will be something like a flu shot, where even if you're fully vaccinated, you have both your shots now, or your one Johnson & Johnson dose? 6 months from now, a year from now, will we still be lining up to get new coronavirus vaccines?
So from the standpoint of the antibody response that you get from these vaccines, we're still waiting to basically hear about that. So one of the differences between these vaccine trials and other ones is that prior to COVID, pharmaceutical companies would monitor that antibody response from the vaccine and see how long it lasted and when it started to kind of drop and taper off. And just due to the nature of this pandemic, you know, we felt like you can't wait 3 to 5 years to figure out when to do a booster. We just needed to start giving vaccine. So they continue that part of the trial, and we'll know more as time goes on as far as how long that immunity lasts from a vaccine. But my suspicion is that we're going to see boosters as we get into late 2021 and 2022, and those are going to be more geared towards treating variants. And so it's kind of a booster, but not so much for the overall longevity of the immunity, but it's more to cover some of the variants that are popping up.
So the more we do to stomp that out now, the better off we are in 21 fall, winter, and 22, correct?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, the better we can keep COVID virus numbers down, the faster we can get people vaccinated, then the less likely we're going to see more variants pop up. So integral part is continuing to do those basic things as far as masking, social distancing, and so on, and then trying to get people to get vaccinated when they can.
Yeah. Dr. Chanturi is a family medicine physician, regional director of clinical quality with Avera Medical Group, and we put a link up to Avera's vaccinations on our website, sdpb.org/news, under today's show notes. And of course, you can find links for all the vaccinations on the South Dakota State Department of Health website at covid.sd.gov. Dr. Turi, thanks for being here. We really appreciate your time once again.
Thank you for having me again, Lori.
This week in 1946, the Aberdeen Railway Station Canteen shut down after serving thousands of meals to service members during World War II. The canteen became famous for serving pheasant sandwiches to military personnel traveling through Aberdeen by passenger train. It started in 1943 when Aberdeen civic leaders met to discuss what the community could do on the home front to help the war effort. Someone suggested starting a canteen in the lobby of the railroad depot because troop trains would be running on the lines. The canteen opened in August that year. The Milwaukee Railroad installed hot and cold running water in the depot lobby, created a serving area. The actual sandwich preparation was done in the meeting rooms of the Milwaukee Road Women's Club. Each morning, vegetables were cleaned and ground with a small hand-turned food chopper. A vegetable and egg mixture was mixed with ground pheasant or minced ham for sandwiches. During the 15-minute stopover in Aberdeen, troops were served minced ham sandwiches unless they specifically asked for the pheasant. One kind tasted as good as the other, but a few pheasants a day would not feed 1,000 men. With volunteer help from Aberdeen, surrounding communities, and the USO and Red Cross, the canteen continued to serve thousands of sandwiches to troops until it closed down 75 years ago this week. An exhibit of the World War II Pheasant Canteen is on display at the Aberdeen Elks Lodge. Up next, we hear a story of survival and suffering on Images of the Past. You're on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Carl Gerke, and on the next Jazz Nightly New Music Monday, we've got the latest from legendary Hammond B3 organist Dr. Lonnie Smith, which features guest vocals from Iggy Pop. Vocalist Jane Monheit is out with her first album in 5 years. It's called Come What May, and it has new takes on familiar standards. And saxophonist Greg Abate plays Kenny Barron compositions on his new album. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
SDPB's extensive legislative coverage includes, in their own words, hear debates and conversations from South Dakota's legislators. In Their Own Words is supported by SDN Communications. More at sdncommunications.com.
To build the ag community, early residents of Mitchell marketed their community by putting up the harvest, literally on a building. And a version of the world's only corn palace has been around ever since. The palace is our home base for the next Dakota life, with stops at Ruskin Park in Forestburg, Storybook Land, a classroom outside, and a basketball court in Yankton. It's Greetings from the Corn Palace on the Next Dakota Life, Thursday, April 2nd at 8, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. sdpb.org/donate. Arts, literature, and music reporting on SDPB is supported by the Northern State University School of Fine Arts. More information available at northern.edu.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We talk a lot in South Dakota about veterans and heroes and the price of war. Well, today's Images of the Past features a Union soldier from the Civil War who ended up in the city of Del Rapids in South Dakota, joining us with an extraordinary tale of grit, determination, and survival is Bill Hoskins. He's director of the Siouxland Heritage Museums. Bill, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Always happy to have a talk, Lori.
This is such an incredible story, and listeners can go to sdpb.org and see pictures and some of the narrative of John W. January. Tell us a little bit about who this man was.
Well, John January was a young man born in Clinton County, Ohio in 1847. And in 1864, when he was just 17 years old, he enlisted in Company B of the 14th Illinois Cavalry. And the 14th Illinois was part of Sherman's army in its campaign to take Atlanta, Georgia, and then eventually the March to the Sea. And John January, during that campaign, he was in a cavalry regiment, and they were sent on a raid of Macon, Georgia in July of 1864 with the intent to destroy the railroad. Mm-hmm. And John January was one of 28 people who were captured or wounded that day in his regiment. And he was taken to a fairly new prisoner of war camp at that time called Andersonville. It was actually called Camp Sumter by the Confederates, but at Andersonville, Georgia. And that prison camp was about 26 and a half acres, a big rectangle with the a creek that flowed through the center. And at the time John January got there, there were about 31,000 Union prisoners held in that 25-acre parcel of land.
Wow.
They weren't well fed, and John noticed one day that his feet had become infected, and he went and sought help, and a doctor said, "You're already dead." He said, "You've got gangrene in both your feet. You're going to die. There's nothing I can do for you." And John went back, and he amputated his own feet with a pocket knife.
And he lives to write about this. He tells this story of just saying, you know, I'm not done yet. And he finds a pocket knife, which he keeps and is able to have for the rest of his life. And he literally saws off amputates his own feet.
Yeah.
This is astonishing.
He was actually paroled, released in March of 1865, along with 187 other ailing men. He got to David's Island, New York, a hospital there. He weighed 45 pounds.
Wow.
He's a guy that at one point stood 5'8" in height and 45 pounds, spent 6 months recovering. But he didn't stop there. He eventually came west and homesteaded in the Del Rapids area in 1889. And so he was a farmer. And these are in the days. There weren't tractors to ride on. It was horse work. And during the winter, he gave lectures about his experiences.
Yeah. So he gets married. He has children. He becomes a farmer, and he becomes a community leader. Say more about this notion of him sort of representing these soldiers who have, you know, come out of this war with horrific injuries and really getting up and talking about that, because that is another, you know, incredible act of courage.
Well, he was very involved in veterans organizations of the time. The Grand Army of the Republic, which was the Civil War Veterans American Legion, I like to say. And he was a member and the commander of the post in Del Rapids and belonged to another regional group called the Lake Madison Veterans Association. But also in the late 1890s, there was this whole, what they called a Chautauqua movement. And during the summer, they'd have Chautauqua tents, and you'd have speakers come and talk about life experiences and self-improvement and all kinds of things. Well, John January hit the Chautauqua circuit talking about his experiences during the war as a prisoner of war and just how he survived it.
Yeah. In the photograph that we have on the Images of the Past blog post, he has artificial legs. Was he wheelchair bound? Was he walking with prosthetics? Tell me a little bit about what we know about how he got around.
Well, I don't know really a lot. He did have two peg legs. And that didn't make him unique among veterans of that time period. And he did apparently get around. And there are a number of photos of him. There's one that was taken when he was just released. There's another one of him posing with his legs many years later as a veteran. Mm. And he lived in Del Rapids until 1906.
And that's where he was buried, yeah?
Yep, in the Del Rapids Cemetery.
Yeah. So you walk by some of those old headstones, some of which you can't read, and there is a story behind so many of them. Bill Hoskins, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today with this incredible story.
Okay. Thanks, Lori. Anytime.
Well, concerts are returning to South Dakota from Memorial Day through Labor Day. Deadwood will stage the largest series of open-air concerts in the town's history at the new Outlaw Square on historic Main Street, featuring artists like Big and Rich, Sublime with Rome, Dwight Yoakam, and Clay Walker. Joining us to preview the Deadwood Live open-air music series, we welcome Mark Oswald. He is CEO of Oswald Entertainment Group. Mark, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Lori. And I was listening to the story that you were just doing, and I just thought it was beautiful. And the gentleman that you had on the line, his tone and his appreciation for the subject matter, which is great. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Bill Hoskins is a real Civil War scholar, and we feel very grateful that he, you know, is a repository for these stories and shares them with our listeners. And you have quite a connection to South Dakota and to the community of Deadwood as well. Tell us a little bit about the open air music series and how it kind of came to be in this really new venue in Deadwood.
Be happy to, and I'm excited to share this. I first experienced Deadwood in 1999 at the recommendation of Willie Nelson and a guy named Bill McDavid, who told me if I brought John Rich and Big Kenny up there, they'd probably write historic music. And so I finally got them up there in about 2000, and sort of the rest is history. Big and Rich was created, and the first show they ever played actually was in Deadwood at the Bodega Bodega. They worked for drinks in an apartment up above the bodega there at the stockade. And here we are some 20 years later, bringing them back to headline and open the Deadwood Live open air music series at Outlaw Square. And it's just such a neat full circle arc. And we have been in love with the Black Hills and the Deadwood area ever since we experienced it some 22 years ago.
I don't think I've ever heard that story before of that origin. What a delightful, what a delightful thing to know. Tell me about this this venue and sort of how it compares to some of the other already iconic music venues across the country.
Indeed. Well, I think it's common knowledge, especially in South Dakota and the general area there, the adjoining states, how special the Black Hills are, and in particular Deadwood, South Dakota, as a National Historic District. So I've been on the road touring since 1980 in the music business. I started with the group Alabama years and years ago, and have seen, I would say, probably every meaningful venue in America, both indoors and outdoors. And the ones that really sort of resonate with me on the outdoor model are places like Red Rocks in Denver, or Wolf Trap in Vienna, Virginia. The Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. These are venues that are legendary venues that are attractions unto themselves. And Outlaw Square on Main Street in Deadwood, right, it's right between the Hickok and Silverado, across the street from the Franklin, was so beautifully built and opened about a year ago during COVID. And I looked at the stage and I looked at what they had done there, and it was just screaming for top name entertainment in that sort of intimate historic environment. And so luckily was able to work out a deal with the city and the Outlaw Square board, a guy that runs it, or the executive director, Bobby Rock, and they've got a great board, and with the chamber to bring headline talent to Deadwood outdoors. And the Deadwood Mountain Grand, of course, we built that facility and started a whole series of indoor headline shows. But, you know, any really cool destination town needs to have an outdoor venue for the summer and an indoor venue for the colder months. And so now with Outlaw Square, Deadwood is teed up with a historic venue in the middle of a historic town. And it's as good as anything I've seen in America, and better than most.
So you're planning this and having some of these conversations during the pandemic, when people are realizing what they've lost in not being able to go see live music, and what it's sort of taken, what the pandemic sort of took from us, and really appreciating some of those experiences all the more. But yet you're also planning it with this great deal of uncertainty, not knowing what exactly is going to happen, from politically to, you know, infection rates to restrictions. Talk a little bit about the optimism and the determination it must take to have some of those conversations when the future is anything but certain.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would say this, another part of my business is the artist management business. So we manage artists that tour. And when COVID hit, that went instantly to zero, as everybody knows. It was really difficult, and has been and still is, for all of the musicians and crew and all the associated businesses to survive. So we were dealing with it on the artist management side, and then also on the television production side. I produce a number of TV series. They're all music related. One is in particular that airs in Sioux Falls and in Rapid City called The Song. recorded live from TGL Farms. It airs on, I can't remember which stations, but you can go to thesong.tv to check it out. And it's all major acts. And we, during COVID, figured out how to get out there and still shoot. And we shot Jewel and Train and Jason Mraz and Clint Black, a bunch of acts during the COVID. And we did it with heavy protocol. We shot the Marley family down in Florida. So it was about understanding the challenge, not waving a white flag, and just being responsible. And it worked out really good. So I would say those experiences through managing and through television production through COVID really helped sort of frame our approach to how could we do live events in Deadwood this summer. And also, I think the state of South Dakota has handled the COVID challenge better than most. There's absolutely no doubt about that, because I've traveled so much from coast to coast, number one. And number two is outdoors. You know, there's a sense that outdoor entertainment's probably better in this current environment, in the COVID environment, because of the fresh air and so forth. So, you know, when you combine outdoors with a state, the mayor of Deadwood is a guy named Dave Ruth, Mayor Ruth. Got a mayor that really gets it, and how to you know, help businesses stay in business and at the same time do it with some extreme sense of responsibility. I just think South Dakota and Deadwood in particular are examples of how to basically stay in business and keep the music playing and do it in a proper way.
Yeah, musicians are essential. We have been saying that about the arts throughout this entire pandemic, and they have taken such a hit economically, this entire
it's
industry.
So important. Well,
Deadwood
about musicians.
Yeah,
about
very
musicians.
Quickly. About 15 seconds.
There are 6,000 private event clubs in America that employ countless musicians and raise hundreds of millions of dollars every year for charity. And those clubs as well, the showcase clubs for the new artists, have really taken a hit, and we should all be aware of that.
The Deadwood Live Open Air Music Series kicks off May 29th with Big and Rich featuring Cowboy Troy. We're going to put some links up on our website. You can find out more about this remarkable new concert series. Our guest has been Mark Oswald. Thank you so much, Mark, for your devotion to South Dakota. We appreciate your time today.
Well, we love your state, and thank you very much.